with shows like Whose Line Is It Anyway? And Have I Got News For You? And with his own stand-up shows, Paul Merton has been at the forefront of British comedy for close to 30 years. Now, in Funny Ha Ha, a new anthology of stories selected and introduced by Merton, not only do we get a real sense of his own comical tastes, but we learn the possible origins of his comic talent might be traced back, in fact, to his schoolboy compositions. Paul Merton joins me now from London. Let's start with the schoolboy yes. compositions, Paul, and the budgie. Amos the Turk. Who was Amos the Turk?
That was just a name that came to me when I was about 14. I can know how surreal it is to suddenly be asked about Amos the Turk, an essay I wrote when I was 14 years old by a very distinguished broadcaster like yourself. English was my favourite, by far my favourite subject at school. Writing English essays was my favourite subject. Creating, I wasn't thinking them as stories at the time, but I suppose that's what they were. And I would sort of like, you know, I would write a version of it and then do a redraft of it and then perhaps another redraft. And I just really enjoyed the idea of creating a story or creating a character. And I think the story with Amos the Turk, who was a budgie, if I remember rightly, was the teacher thought it was very good, and I was invited to read it out to the rest of the class. So it was one of those first occasions where an adult says, oh, you're good at this. And that gives you a lot of confidence when you're sort of, you know, an early age.
Yeah, but he wasn't so, this, I presume, was the English teacher a he or a she, can you remember?
He
was a little bit critical when it came to the end of your story, however.
yes, that's right. I think I was coming to the end of the story and I couldn't quite think how to finish it, so I then sort of wrote, I then hailed a passing taxi, climbed into it and was never seen again.
Yeah.
And then he wrote in the margin, he said, you can't say you were never seen again. Other people can say you were never seen again, but you can't say that. I don't think he was right. But I then, the next story, you know, was something like, I was in the middle of the jungle surrounded by pygmies when I hailed a passing taxi and was never seen again. And he says, oh, right. He wrote in red letters in the thing. That's enough. And I don't think he was right. You can say I was never seen again because, if you know, you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously he accepted it, and therefore you had the voice of authority backing you up. I wouldn't have thought that the voice of authority was that important to you at any point along the way.
Well, I worked for the civil service for about 3 years, and I wasn't very good at that. I worked at the Department of Employment, so that was a very serious job. People would come in and apply for training courses and things like that. And I enjoyed that aspect of it, helping people, you know. But I was not a very good civil servant. I said to the manager of the job centre that I was in, I said, I left on February the 29th, 1980. I wanted to wait for the leap year day, so I'd never forget which day it was. And I said to him just before I left, I said, now, if I was to sort of like stay, I said, what would be my promotional prospects? And he laughed. He laughed for about 30 seconds. I mean, I thought he was going to have a hernia. He laughed so much. He said, well, the best I could do is forget the first 3 years. So I was never going to be. But I do, you remind me now, I remember in 1979, another manager there who was there at the time said, now, this might seem a bit sort of, I was about 22 at the time. He said, now, this might seem a bit premature. He said, but we have a marvellous pension scheme. 22. There aren't many 22-year-olds who go, yes, I'll stay here for another 40-odd years and that'd be great. So I'd still be working there now if I hadn't taken the leap into the dark.
How many of the 80 of the funniest stories ever written that appear in this book, Funny Ha Ha, might have been read at your desk during your time in the civil service?
Oh, certainly. I mean, quite a few of them were very new to me. But the P.G. Woodhouse, for certain. There's a story in there called Mulliner's Buck You Uppo, which is sort of a magic potion which gives you energy. There was Just Williams stories by a woman, Richmill Crompton. I remember reading those, were probably the first funny stories I remember reading. Spike Milligan is in there with a Goon Show script. Again, that would be when I was about sort of 8, 9, 10, something like that. But a lot of the stories are, oh, Flann O'Brien. He was somebody that I got into very much in my mid-teens as well. And there's two or three good, really funny stories from him. Your listeners will no doubt be very familiar with him. There was a lot of sort of childhood ones, but also quite modern ones as well, because I have sort of fallen out of the habit of reading short stories. And the book was took more work to put together than I first thought, because most authors don't write short stories, and most short stories aren't intended to be funny. So you have to sort of read quite a few, which I was happy to do. And there's a lot of sort of Kevin Barry's in there, sort of still a fairly sort of young Irish writer. He's in there, Beer Trip to Clandudno, which is a great story. And I'm pleased with how it's been received. The Sunday Times over here gave it the best humour book of the year. In one of their sort of roundups recently, and people who have sort of looked at it, it's quite eclectic. There's a lot of different stuff in there, you know.
Yeah, and it is, and I mean, not only stories, it has to be said, because while it has that subtitle, Lady of the Funniest Stories in the World, you've touched on the fact there that there are radio scripts in there from Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Yes,
and
indeed,
from Roy Galton and Alan Simpson, who used to do Hancock's half-hour scripts. You used to tape the stuff off the radio, reel-to-reel recorder.
Oh, yes, yeah, back in the 70s, on a reel-to-reel tape recorder, as it was then, which I bought off a boy at school. And that was, I mean, today's technology, of course, is all pervasive. I mean, it would seem a very strange thing to get excited about being able to record something. But in those days, in the 1970s, the BBC they weren't selling off audio tapes of shows or CDs of shows or anything like that. So the only way you could listen to something again was to record it yourself. So I would on more than one occasion, hold up a microphone to the radio speaker. And, you know, the rest of the family had been told not to come into the room for half an hour while I sort of listened to this, you know, taped it, and then was able to listen to it back again. So one of the Hancock shows that I recorded, Sid's Mystery Tours, was one that I, for very sentimental reasons, I included in this book, because I'm a big fan of comedy writing, but some of my real favourite comedy writers never wrote short stories. So Gorton and Simpson are in there, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore are in there, their sketches. Victoria Wood, she never wrote short stories, but I put three of her TV pieces in there. And I suppose the criterion really was that as long as they read funny on the page, then you can justify their inclusion.
Yeah, but what's really interesting about, at one level to me, about your taping off the radio, you're talking there about taping to listen back. And even when you were talking about your schoolboy compositions, you were talking about drafting and redrafting. Now,
yes,
my schoolboy compositions were get it done, get the full stop, have I got two pages finished, into the bag, I'm out. Clearly you were a different type of student.
I was. Well, I because I was so enthralled by the whole business of comedy, you know, making people laugh, that I wanted to, and I knew then even, I mean, it seems very odd, but from a very early age, like three or four, I remember seeing clowns at a circus and being just totally obsessed with what the clowns were doing and creating that marvellous atmosphere of laughter. And when I was, you know, in my mid-teens, I couldn't even begin to think how I'd become a performer, but I knew that I could practice my writing, my comedy writing, because you don't need anybody, you just need a pen and a paper to do that. And so you would write a story and then sort of look at it again and slightly rewrite it and just try and improve my own writing ability just by, you know, giving myself these certain sort of tasks to make it a story. Oh, you've just reminded me of something. Now, this is something I'd forgotten, but when I was 8 years old, on my eighth birthday, I remember having this thought. That I remember thinking on my eighth birthday that I was making the other kids laugh at school, and I thought, well, next year I've got to keep doing this, and then I'm going to be nine, and they're going to be nine, they're going to be a bit older, so it's going to be a bit harder for me to make them laugh. So thank you for this interview, because you've reminded me of something I've completely forgotten about. But that is, a quite odd thing for an eight-year-old to think.
Yeah.
I have to make them laugh when I'm 16 years old. And that's what I thought at the time. I had to keep... It really was a total vocation for me.
Yep, keeping ahead of the curve, really, at the age of eight.
Yes,
it has to be said.
Yes, indeed.
Let's talk about the specifics, maybe, of a couple of the stories. And you mentioned Mulliner's Buck You Up. Oh, great title for a tonic. Now, I don't know if the phrase goes with you, you know, he was a tonic, as well as a tonic being something that bucks you up. So give us a sense of Mulliner and his Buck You Up O-Tonic.
Well, it's there's two bishops involved, and there's a sort of a young man who wants to become, who's, I think he's a curate, I think.
Yes.
And he's rather shy individual. And he gets hold of some of this tonic and drinks it, and suddenly becomes a very boisterous, determined young man who knows exactly what he wants to do. And the very funny scenes between the two bishops who knew each other at school, so they are constantly taunting themselves about schoolboy escapades. I can't remember what they're like, putting a mouse in somebody's desk or something.
And not
like that,
eating the right lunches. It's classic P.G. Wodehouse territory, really, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yes. I mean, he is... there aren't many P.G. Wodehouses around, an author that would dedicate themselves to just writing writing comedy story, you know, short stories, novels and stuff, but comedy novels. I don't think he ever wrote anything serious in his life. So, but you'll find that most writers actually aren't like that. So he was, I mean, you know, there has been compilations of P.G. Wodehouse stories just on his own sort of output. So I was very keen to, there's one in there, which is, I think it's The Hunting of the Spottismore, I think, which is a very short story about treating flies, catching flies, as if it was big game. And that's a very funny, and that's not one that I knew. So yeah. With some of the better known authors, I was always hoping to find something that wasn't so well known. So you there will be some stories that are classics of their kind. The James Thurber one, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, for example, is something that you would expect to be in there. But I'm hoping that a lot of the others as well are stories that people aren't familiar with.
And in the case of Oscar Wilde, first of all, we should ascertain the Irish connections. You've got this.
Yes.
You got this on. Who Do You Think You Are, the programme. An Irish...
Yes, indeed.
An Irish grandfather, explain more, because it's dedicated, the book is dedicated to him.
It is, yes. Well, there was my mother's father. He was the legend that we grew up with as a family, and my Irish cousins in Cork had heard the same story, was that he'd been lost at sea. He was in the Merchant Navy, 1927, he'd been lost at sea, and the terribly tragic... not that's tragic enough, but when the news was broken to his wife, she was 6 months pregnant, she went into early labour, she died, the child died. So within 3 days, father, mother, newborn baby boy, all gone. My mother, who was only one at the time, which was probably a blessing because she didn't have very many memory of this. She was brought up by friends of the family, and so she had one picture of my grandfather Jimmy, as we called him, although he's down as James, but I think he was probably known as Jimmy. So this BBC One programme, Who Do You Think You Are, I sort of contacted them and they said, oh, it seems like an interesting story. But we found out, I was in Cardiff, in the public records office there, just opposite the Cardiff City football ground, and we found out that my grandfather had actually died in Cardiff. They'd come off the boat which had come back from Argentina, Brazil. He was a stoker. He was basically, when steamships were around, you had somebody in, you know, who was sort of, you know, shoveling coal into a fire, 4 hours on, 4 hours off. Very hard work, very difficult, hot, sweaty, back-breaking hard labour, really. And he died. He died in Cardiff. He had a heart attack and fell into a canal and was found. The body was found 2 or 3 days later after he'd been fallen in. He's in an unmarked grave in a cemetery in Cardiff, and none of my family knew any of this. We'd always been told that he'd been lost at sea, but actually it was a very... So we don't know whether... Somebody back in 1927 said, well, there's no need for the family to know about this because it's such a terrible ending for somebody. So if we say he's lost at sea, there's obviously no body that can be found or whatever. But he's in an unmarked grave in a cemetery in Cardiff. So what I'm going to do at the beginning, when the weather gets a little bit warmer, and April would be roughly the time, it was in April that he died, we're going to put up a tombstone for him. Because they know exactly where the grave is,
right?
But there's nothing there to. They I was told at the time there probably would have been a wooden cross or something put up at the time. But of course, over the course of 90 odd years, that wouldn't
have survived. And lovely that you've dedicated the collection of stories to him in that way as well. That's
yes,
kind of
well, a... I mean, I could well have known him. You know, I could well have known him, and such a sad ending that we sort of. And it was shortly after that I'd done the programme that I was doing the book, so I thought, well, I'll put in a dedication to him.
I'm wondering to what extent is that Irish background. And was it a part of what sent you toward Oscar Wilde, for example, is in the book, as you mentioned, Flann O'Brien, he would have to be there, really, if we're talking about comic writing in Ireland. And,
and
Kevin Barry's story, which is kind of comic at one level, but also quite poignant and serious at another level, the beer trip to Clondudno.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think the sort of, providing that there was a comic element to the story, I wasn't being too sort of... strict. I mean, I loved the story. I thought it was great. And
it's a group of men on a train, a really ill group. They're heading off to
exactly.
This pub in Clondudno. Effectively, is
exactly. They talk about the different strength of beer and all that kind of stuff. It's a story about male bonding, I suppose. And it sort of struck me, there is humour to it, but also you say, yeah, there is a poignancy to it as well. And I think there are some of the stories which are... There's one story by the famous English writer...
Somerset Maugham, yeah.
Which is it's only funny in the last line. There's a marvellous reveal at the end of the five or six pages, because up to that point, it's like a long shaggy dog story, but you get the joke right at the very end. I don't know if you've read that one, but it's...
Well, I'll tell you what really struck me in that case was it again, portrays your origins as a comedian. I mean, it is the punchline. It's a long word. Yes. It's a long setup for the punchline.
It is.
But it is the punchline that works.
Yeah,
there.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And most short stories don't end up with a punchline, but that one definitely does. So it was if it was amusing to me, then I would put it in.
Recently on Have I Got News for You, you spoke about the Doyle printer. Do you remember,
Do you remember
this story?
Yes, I do. A couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, too big for the space that it...
Make a bit of a splash over there, did it?
Well, it made quite a splash, still making bits of a splash. Even as the weeks go on. I know you spoke about speaking to your Irish cousins about your grandfather and his historical... Did you speak to them about the Doyle printer or any... Are you in regular contact with them?
No, I haven't yet. No, I haven't spoken to them about it, but I think it might be a sort of small embarrassment for them, but you know, as an Englishman living in England, I'm hardly in a position to point at somebody else's embarrassments at this particular moment in time.
Yeah, I wondered had you found in your search, because we have, I don't know exactly how many writers we have across the 80 stories, probably something upwards of, I don't know, 30 something,
50 odd, I think
50 something. Is there anybody in there who could write a story that might capture the comic essence of the past, shall we say, 5-6 decade, perhaps 10 years in your country? Can farce explain it to us? Can satire explain it to us in a way that perhaps serious writing can't?
Well, sometimes, perhaps, you know, we need to be able to laugh at things. If we laugh at subjects, it takes away the sting of it a little bit, and it makes it slightly less frightening, perhaps. I'm sure there will be. I mean, now that it's all been settled and we're leaving the European Union at the end of January, there'll be that aspect of it has now come to a full stop. So I'm sure that somebody is writing a novel, even as we speak, or a play that's going to be sort of, you know, Exit to Brexit or something it will be called. And
did you find yourself laughing? Could you laugh last Thursday evening into Friday morning when you were watching the election results?
Well, because our Have I Got News for You programme was being recorded on Friday morning at 10 o'clock in the morning, so that we could know the result. I saw the exit polls, which turned out to be remarkably accurate, at about 10:05, and then sort of headed up after that, really. Headed to bed after that. It's everybody, I think, was rather astonished by the result. You have the large parts of former Labour constituencies voting very heavily for the Tories. So I hope their trust will not be misplaced.
I'd like to finish with, which is a poignant story at the end of it all, but I thought there was something lovely in this that I read that you had said, at the time of the death of your wife, Sarah, in 2003,
yes.
Paul,
yes.
The role that comedy played in helping you with that grief, in fact.
Yes. Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I do a regular show every Sunday at the Comedy Store here in London, an impro show to Comedy Store players, and Sarah died on a Monday morning at about 2:00 in the morning. And the following Sunday, I went down to the Comedy Store, not to perform, because I thought that might be sort of misconstrued a little bit. Who might, you know, Sarah had only been dead for a few days. But I just wanted to be in the room. So I was in the room with sort of 300-400 people in the audience. I stood at the back, so nobody really knew I was there. But just to be in a place where laughter was being generated, where people were having a good time, where, because, you know, through the process of laughter, when we're laughing at something, a very funny joke or whatever it is, or a moment that we recollect or something, while we're laughing at that, we can think of nothing else. It takes over our being for that moment. So we're not worried about mortgages, we're not worried about the children's education, we're not worried about the hole in our shoe, whatever it would be. For that moment, we are taken somewhere else, and of pure joy. And I think it is the most extraordinary mechanism as human beings that we have access to. And I think it helps us through bad times. And so I knew that was the place I wanted to be. I went on stage the following week after that because the joy of being in an audience is equaled by the joy of the performer, particularly in an improvised show when you don't know what you're going to be saying next. So we get as much of a kick from it as the audience does. So it was very important part of the whole healing process of dealing with that initial grief.
And I guess people who want to get a little bit of a healing process or a laugh for themselves in a room by themselves can do so by reading Funny Ha Ha, the collection of stories that Paul Merton...
What a great link that was. Well done.
You should have done it at the end of your...
I should have done it, yeah.
Paul Merton speaking to us about Funny Ha Ha, 80 of the funniest stories ever written. It's published by Head of Zeus.